Did you know some travel credit cards offer 10 times points on your spending? Don't miss out on big rewards for your next trip. NerdWallet lets you compare smart travel credit cards side by side, curated by an expert team of finance nerds. What could future you do with better travel rewards? A free flight? A room upgrade? Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. Reminder, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply. NerdWallet, finance smarter. The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G-connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
You don't just live in your home, you live in your neighborhood as well. So when you're shopping for a home, you want to know as much about the area around it as possible. Luckily, Homes.com has got you covered. Each listing features a comprehensive neighborhood guide from local experts. Everything you'd ever want to know about a neighborhood, including the number of homes for sale, transportation, local amenities, cultural attractions, unique qualities, and even things like median lot size and a noise score. Homes.com. We've done your homework.
Pushkin. This is Talk Easy. I'm Sam Fragoso. Welcome to the show. Today, we return to our very special conversation with artist Marina Abramović. She's currently the subject of a show at the Royal Academy of Arts in London, making her the first female artist to host a major solo exhibition at the 255-year-old institution. The recognition is long overdue as a pioneer in performance art, which she began creating back in the 1970s. Throughout her career, she's often tested her own physical limits in ways we haven't seen in public spaces before or since. And yet, perhaps her most daring performance, the one that you probably know her from, is her most sedentary. In The Artist is Present from 2009, Marina sits silently at a wooden table in which a queue of people, one by one, sit across from her in a chair waiting to be occupied. Over the course of nearly 3 months, for 8 hours a day, inside the MoMA atrium in New York City, she met the gaze of over 1,000 strangers, many of whom were moved to tears in her presence. The piece would garner Marina international recognition, catapulting performance art into a larger cultural conversation, a conversation that continues here today on our show, as both Marina and I discuss her 5 decades of groundbreaking work and how she continues to create art out of hardship at the age of 76. I sat down with her last year inside her New York City apartment, and to help illustrate exactly what we're talking about, we've put together a virtual exhibit displaying some of the pieces discussed in this conversation. If you'd like to follow along as you listen, you can visit our website at talkeasypod.com. That's talkeasypod.com. We've also included a link in the description of this episode. We'll be back next Sunday with a new episode with a guest that we have long wanted to have on this show. Until then, here's my talk with artist Marina Abramović. I hope you enjoy.
You know why the people don't like to people get into the apartments because they don't like to reveal anything about themselves. But I don't have secrets. I have no secrets, which is so incredibly relaxing.
You may be the first person to ever come on the show with no secrets.
You know, when I do things, I am here with you. I'm not where else.
That's how I do the show.
Yeah.
Marina, thank you for having me in your apartment. This is very unusual, especially in pandemic times.
I think I totally ignore pandemic times. Looks to me, I don't know, I work more than ever. I travel more than ever. I'm really lucky I never got sick. I got all vaccinations, boosters, and like everybody else. But to me, the pandemic time... Okay, sorry.
What's that?
It's a ring.
Is it you?
Yes.
The bell rang. Marina walked to the door. Now she returns.
They're renovating there. They're kind of mixing the door. Okay. So... my pandemic time was incredibly creative. For an artist, solitude is so important. In these 2 years, there was plenty of solitude. Also, for me, nature was very important. I developed this exercise that to go to nature and look at the tree you really like and hug the tree and complain within minimum 15 minutes. And I done this in England, and people really start complaining much longer than 15 minutes, so much to complain in England. They start crying, they start pouring their heart out and talk about their lives. I really understood how much nature can heal.
Well, we're going to do a whole show with very little complaints. We're not going to complain too much.
I'm not complaining type. I actually am very positive. You know, to me, when I see something very tragic, something very difficult is happening, it's always reason behind to really understand why things are happening, is not happening. I love this saying of Sufis. I think it's Rumi. He say, the worst is the best. And why? Because then when it comes to the bottom of things, then somehow the gravitation force pulls you up after every rainy days of the sun.
How are you grappling with what's happening in Russia and Ukraine?
I was just reflecting on this whole thing. You know, first of all, I just been there. So my relation to this is really like something's happening to my family and it's devastating. And I just been in Kiev, walking on the streets and seeing the buildings being demolished and the suffering and the people in the subways and no food and no electricity, no water. And feel almost guilty how lucky I am here. I'm here in America and I just, go to the bathroom and have a hot shower anytime I want. And then also the question, but what you can do in this situation, how you can help? I also have the same questions when it was war in my country, in ex-Yugoslavia. And then I realized the only thing I can do is do my work as best as I can and give the message through art. In that time in Yugoslav war, I created this piece, Balkan Baroque, which I washed the bones repeatedly for 5 days in a 30 degrees Celsius when the warmth was coming out of the meat and blood was everywhere. And the message was that you never can wash the blood from your own hands. And that image is looking very apocalyptic, you know, me sitting on the pile of 2,500 bones and try to wash them without any result.
That was in 1997?
Yeah, exactly. But the part of this more important was it was for that moment from my country. But that image, I also want to be transcendental. I want to be that image that we can use over and over again, wherever war is somewhere. So now is Ukraine. Just before this war started, the last, only a few months ago, I've been several times in Ukraine because I was invited to build monument for Babi Yar. Babi Yar, it's one of the very dark part of history of the Second World War. In 1943, 130,000 Jewish people, gay people, and the gypsies been killed in 3 days, stripped naked and killed on the hill and thrown into the mass grave. And then after that, it was just put the concrete over this whole thing and became the park. And this park stays through the Nazi period, through Ukraine period, and Russian came and Ukraine came back into the independence. And never been any kind of memory about that event. And some Holocaust people who still survive, some people who remember this whole thing, and never had any point that they can actually mourn or they can, sit in silence and reflect on this event till Zelensky, the president, came. And Brzezinski is a Jewish, and he felt his duty as the first thing, actually, to create the park of the memory about Babi Yar. And he invited some artists, and I made the proposal, and my proposal was accepted. And I was very touched and really full responsibility what I'm going to do there. So I was thinking how I can conceptually prolong this wall of prayer in Jerusalem all the way to the Ukraine, into the wall of crying, healing, and forgiveness. And I came with this idea of 40-meter, very big wall, enormous, I don't know how many tons, actually, to construct freestanding wall in this park. And the wall was made from the coal, black coal, who is actually came out of Ukraine. And then I ordered 250 pure crystals from the middle of the mines in Brazil. And I positioned them in three places, in exactly position of the head, heart, and stomach, with the different sizes of people, including the children. And the instruction of that wall was that you go in there, face the wall, and press at 3 points of your body against the crystals, and close your eyes and just contemplate, remember, and also get healing from crystals that historically had been possible. And it was incredible to see 40 people standing against the wall. And when was the opening of this old Babi Yar event, for the opening came Zelensky, came the president of Germany and the president of Israel. And these three presidents never faced the wall in their life. They always faced the audience. And I asked them actually to face the wall, and they did. And this was a very historical moment, you know. The idea of that monument is there for healing. And before the attack of Russia, there was already so many rumors in Ukraine. The wall would start frequently to be used more and more and more. And I hope there will still, after this hell finish one day, I hope the wall will be still there.
Something you said early on, you and I, sitting here in this beautiful apartment in New York, you feel some kind of guilt that you're here and your friends are in Ukraine. How much of your work do you think comes from a place of guilt?
I don't think much, actually, if I think really seriously. Lots of work comes out of missing love, out of loneliness, broken heart, unhappiness. Some kind of big drama. You know, I always think that generally, if you look history of art, it's not too many art come from happiness. You need some kind of push into something that is different than your tranquil life. And always my old theory that, you know, if your childhood, you have great childhood, it's difficult to become good artist because you have to have a difficult childhood because there's so much work to do, to work with. And I'm always, you know, I take my body as a center of the work, like, you know, pushing mental, physical limits, but also the body's universe. And nobody knows even how our brain works. We think that we have 30% working, but actually scientists have just developed the theory that we only have 20% work.
Some people seem to have less than 20%.
Less than, I'm sure. But the thing is that, you know, if I take my body's universe, it's endless exploration. And to me, in my early period of work, I was really kind of pushing these physical limits. And now I'm so much more interested in the brain and mental limits, which is so much harder. But I think the work, if we come just about guilt, I don't think that interested. I think it's so much more important to kind of expand consciousness and see things in a kind of big view. I always love this big view. I don't know. I have this story that everybody should go to the Museum of Natural Art History here in New York. And there is this conservatory. And actually, this is for children mostly. And then you go there and you're lying on these very comfortable chairs. And then all swear open and there is a universe. And then you see a Milky Way. And a tiny little shiny dot, they point it with the laser and say, and this is Earth. And then comes this voice like George Clooney or whatever and say, this is a planet Earth. And we look this tiny little blue thing. And on this tiny little blue thing, how many shit is happening and how much we don't care about these little blue Earths. It's terrible. So I always try to have this view from the plane, you know, on the whole thing, and to see this in the context of the planet, in the cosmic black holes universe. When I was a child, my big question was always, what is behind of the cosmos? Where are we now?
There's a piece of poetry that you discover in your childhood that I think informs the artist as present. It comes from Rilke. It goes, "Earth, isn't this what you want? To arise within us, invisible. Isn't it your dream to be wholly invisible someday? Oh, Earth, invisible. What if not transformation is your urgent command?"
This is so incredible. You see, Rilke is my big, big love. And this was related to the Great Wall that I walked together with Ulay, each of us 2,500 kilometers to come to the middle and say goodbye. One of the reasons we wanted to do this, because NASA report was also that only visible construction, human-made on our planet, can be seen from the moon, from outer space, it's the pyramids and Great Wall of China. So before NASA, before satellites, before anything, the second century poet Chinese said, "Earth is small and blue, and I'm just a little crack in it." Confession of the Great Wall of China. I mean, how you explain this complete astral vision of somebody looking from up into the Earth in the second century?
This idea of transformation, this is recurring throughout your work. The artist is present as being represented by a video installation in this upcoming exhibition. For people who may remember this piece or those who don't know about it, how do you think about this performance now?
You see, this is 12 years later. And one of the reasons why I want to show to actually this piece now in a gallery after 12 years is really that I have very large young audience. My generation is not kind of my audience. And so many of them never had the opportunity to see this work. It's a huge opportunity to actually reconstruct it. But also what is happening in this piece, it's that I documented lifetime exactly, which is insane. We are talking 716 hours of the documentation. I was thinking how I can present this. I was very conscious about recording this historical event, even if you're never going to sit there and look 76 hours, but you, in your mind, you know that's real time, real labor, which I put in, and it's no fake. I never stand up. I never drink the water. I never moved. So it's just to be there present for this period of time. So what we had there, we had one camera who filmed the whole situation, which is two chairs and table, 2 months, and later on table was removed. It's just two chairs. And then we filmed, you know, on one side, me, first months in blue color, because dress was blue, second month in red, I need more energy, and the third month purification, white color. So that each of the square, which is actually film on my face, it's actually 8 hours multiplied by 3 months. The only time that is 10 hours is every Tuesday when museum is open, 10 hours. So it's really created as a diary. On another side, you have people. Every single square is amount of people who sit that day. Some of them sit 5 minutes, 20, 30. I have the guy who sit entire 7 hours. I have the same man sit 21 time in the different periods. I have people returning, coming back, and so on. So the second screen on the opposite is like pulsating up and down, up and down, up and down. And in the middle, you have original two chairs and the table. So it's real time. You go into kind of time capsule to see this piece. And then it's very important, another thing about this installation, the photography. In the 70s, when you record performance art, the photographer never been told what to do, because also performer sometimes is very impulsive or is very improvised, so you never know what's going to happen. And then sometimes it's 15 minutes, 1 hour, 2 hours. So the photographer come, take some shots, go smoke a cigarette, come back, take another shot. So what you see, it's not really exact what happened there. And also is influenced by the vision of photographer, what he see, and not what actually see the performer after seeing documentation. And here I have Marconelli, who I asked to photograph every single person, which means that he's the first photographer in history to be there exact amount of time like me with exact same conditions. He could go to the toilet. He could not go to eat. He had to be there to photograph every single person. And so most of the people sit there and cry. And Marconelli told me that he will actually photograph different sequences, but we also will make the point of waiting that the tear reach the cheek and the light just kind of hit that point that is glowing. Wow, the photographer, we just actually published the book. It's just incredible.
for 760 and a half hours, you're sitting motionless in the MoMA atrium. Again, this is 8 hours a day, every day, 10 hours on Fridays for 3 months. I have a question. We'll come back to some of this later, but I have a question. You and I just sitting here now, you're an extremely excitable, animated person that wants to go from here to here in conversation and offering tea, and you've given me cookies and
Japanese too.
Japanese and all these treats, and I sense a kind of restlessness, even in the pandemic, you are creating endlessly. In the work, when you're sitting there for 3 months, did it calm you in some way?
You know, I don't need to be calm. I am excited. I love things. I love to explore. I'm curious. I love to see every moment the world like a child just, you know, born. This is so important. This, I feel that life in every pore of my body. And the work in the performance work is something else. You enter to another type of yourself. You enter in your super self, how I can say. It's a transition, you know. You create the concept and then you execute this concept. And that's not the life, but is life also. Because 3 months doing this thing become life, become my life, because it was nothing else.
Because there's no division, at that point between art and your life.
And then when I came back out of the performance, I made a big party. I went to the countryside with the 12 friends and we had a blast. We had the love and we had the humor and we have ice cream and we have fun. You know, this is the thing, you know, it's not contradiction. I have so many different people in me, and all of them have a kind of equal presence, and each one come in to function what the concept needs, you know. So I do nothing regularly, you know, like people say, oh my, you meditate every day. No, I'm not. But there is a time that I just wake up and I'm lazy, and laziness is fine too. And then I have some ideas and they're really shitty. So I'm thinking and love about them and I'm not doing it. And then I have an idea, I'm so obsessed by it and I'm so afraid. It's like, hell, I have to do that. Like artist is present. That was a hell of an idea. But it was also opportunity to show the transformative power of performance art by doing absolutely nothing. That was incredible. But it was every day could be the last, how heavy and difficult it was. But that was my chance to do that in a setting of the MoMA Art Museum and put performance right from non-mainstream art into mainstream. And to me, I was 65 when I done MoMA. I could never do this when I was 25. For simple reason, I didn't have this willpower. I didn't have the wisdom. I could not concentration and any of this. 65 was right time and I do it. I mean, now I'm next year 76 and I'm planning very big performance in Royal Academy. And I just done, you know, opera, which I'm directing and playing myself, but not so difficult. You know, but I want to say it's so interesting to explore new territories, to see what's happening. This is not restlessness. This is curiosity.
And I love your curiosity. In 1976, you spoke on the role of the artist. You said, you have to realize that it is the decision of the artist to use their body through which it becomes an instrument. Then you only have to look at the message it carries. You have qualms just like most other people. That is an ethical matter, but the artist has nothing to do with the morality. Once you go over that limit, the matter is about other things. Do you still believe that in 2022, that the artist has nothing to do with morality?
But you know, I just want to also say that taking back all the artist's work, we are talking about performances, we are talking about Fluxus and Happening, we are talking about Futurist, we are talking about Dadaist, just name it, all historical things. It would never happen now because of this, the situation, how everything's judged.
What does that mean?
Look now, political correctness today. Like, you are accused to everything you say, every comment, you can't tell the jokes, you can't say nothing. It's so difficult. And the freedom of artists to be free and say whatever he wants is taken away. So the work that I've been doing in that period will never be possible now. Absolutely not. They will be judged in totally different way, and it's nothing to do with art at all. So this is what I'm really fed up with, political correctness. I love telling jokes. I can't tell any joke anymore because I can't tell jokes about Mexicans. I can't tell about Jewish. I can't tell jokes. The only thing I can tell about Montenegro people are my own. But everything else, I have a great Jewish joke, actually, that I can tell. So the two Jewish guys meet on the street. And one Jewish guy said, okay, tell me, just in one word, how you feel. And the guy said, good. Okay, if you need two words to tell me how you feel, he said, not good. It's so stupid. I love it. It's just simple. And nobody got hurt. Okay.
Well, but hold on. Let's stick on this for one moment before we go back. This is something I hear about often, that political correctness, cancel culture, is getting in the way of true artistic expression. But what has it done to your work? Has it in any way prohibited you from making something you wanted to make?
No.
Haven't you made everything you've wanted?
It's true. Because I don't give a shit about it. This is why I really don't. And I take my freedom. You know, I've been criticized so much constantly. When I was in ex-Yugoslavia doing my early performances, who are now in every art history book, it was terrible things about them, that I should be put in mental hospital and that is not art, that this is shame and so on. And this go on forever. And then I was this poor artist who everybody liked to be discovered. Then I was discovered. Then in MoMA, I was celebrated. Then they start, you know, telling me how I'm celebrity now and this is not art. Then they're using the fashion clothes because I get fashion clothes from the friends. Then I am become this conspiracy theory, which is another shit. You know, that I'm, at least they, before they told me I am satanic priest, now they upgrade me into the high priestess. So, I mean, this go on and on and on.
And by the way, I'm really looking forward to the satanic parties you invited me to.
You know, I am, whatever you do, you know, but, and I'm target and I can't change that. All what I can do is do my work the best as I can, as I've always been doing, regardless of the opinions. And opinions are constantly up and down, up and down. You know, the more you're exposed and the more you're into the world, the more you have hate and love. Nobody's ever indifferent about my work. Or they hate me or they love me.
Isn't that a good thing?
It's how it's supposed to be. I'm not complaining, just noticing.
But sometimes the criticisms bother you.
I hate lies. If I do my work and I give 150% what I'm doing and I give every atom of my energy to the work, I'm okay with this because I can't do more. And whatever you tell me is good or not, I can't change it. But if I don't do this 150%, I'm the worst judge to myself. I get sick. I don't go out to the street. I really know I didn't do my best. But when they're telling me that I am trafficking children and I am Satanist, this is incredibly hurtful because it's total lie and absolutely diminish my function of an artist and my message. That is something that I can't take. Wait, can I tell something more about? I need to get you something.
You're going to give me something?
No, I have to bring something. No, I want to talk about this public image because this man loves
me. Okay. Marina is in the kitchen grabbing what looks to be a newspaper.
Female artists are perceived differently than the male artists. It's kind of interesting. I just want this. This is the Guardian last week. It's a very big article, Guardian. Okay. That, you know, to me, I also like to talk about how somebody made an interview with me recently and they told me, you are the only female artist who have that kind of public image, like Ai Weiwei, like Jeff Koons, like Damien Hirst. Not that the other female artists have. I didn't think that way. But then I'm thinking, yes, if I have that kind of, what kind of image I have? I'm talking just especially about the two Guardians articles recently. One was about my show in October last year in Listen Gallery, and then other one, you know, last week about publishing on my cards, Abramovich Method. You know, I didn't know that when you write the article, the titles for the articles are made from the different organization. So I had the both articles very well written by the people who are the art historian, and they're good, but the titles are incredibly discouraging, diminishing, and vulgar.
They're designed for people to click on it.
And that's something bothers me. And this you don't have with the male artist. You have just with me, who is the only public one here. I mean, okay, this is one just now. No, the one in October was Marina Abramović have a young lover, dirty jokes and mystical crystals. That was the worst kind of summary what my 50 years of my career is. So now I'm publishing this, the cards will be in really well reviews everywhere. And now the cover of the issue in Guardian is culture. For her next tricks, Marina Abramović, artist, provocateur, self-help guru. It's the most ugly titles I can possibly imagine. And I have to live with that. And when you read the article, this doesn't actually reflect the title at all. And why you think, my question to you, is this happening?
I think there's two reasons why. One, people are reading less and less, and publications across the globe have to continue to write headlines that are intentionally provocative to get eyeballs, to get people to click so that advertisers keep coming back. That's the financial part of it. And that's true. The second part is probably what you're saying, which is you're a woman in the public eye. And most of these articles, even when the articles are written by women, the headlines are written by men. So there's clear sexism too.
But, you know, it's one thing to take this when you're in the beginning of your career or the mid of your career. But when you're really 75, it's the last act of your life. You know, how long am I going to live till 80, 90, whatever. I hope 103 as my grandmother. But I just kind of have enough that my work finally should have the kind of weight and understanding which is more profound than these titles.
Well, I agree with you. So why don't we take a break? And when we come back, we'll dive into the work.
As listeners to this show, you probably consider yourself pretty smart. But how smart is your wallet? When you're looking to upgrade your wallet, it's time to turn to NerdWallet. Their expert team of nerds has the financial smarts to help you find the right financial products for you. Before NerdWallet, you might have paid for vacations with whatever was in your wallet, but you could have been missing out on miles you didn't even know you were leaving on the table. Now you can get a new card with more miles and more upgrades. What could future you do with more travel rewards? A hotel upgrade? Lounge access? Wherever you go next, make it happen with a smarter travel card. Don't wait to make smart financial decisions. Compare and find smarter credit cards, savings accounts, and more today at nerdwallet.com. NerdWallet. Finance smarter. As with all cards, credit is subject to lender approval and terms apply.
The most innovative companies are going further with T-Mobile for Business. The PGA of America is helping lower scores and elevate fan experiences with AI coaching tools and 5G connected cameras. AAA is getting more drivers back on the road fast with location telematics. And the Las Vegas Grand Prix is powering race day operations with 5G connectivity, giving fans an experience at the speed they deserve. This is accelerating innovation with T-Mobile for Business. Take your business further at T-Mobile.com/now.
In a few weeks, my friends and I are traveling to see a once-in-a-lifetime event. On April 8th, we're headed south to check out the solar eclipse. And as usual, while we travel, my entire crew will be staying in an Airbnb. Staying in an Airbnb always makes me feel a bit more at home when I travel. But during this trip, I started to think more about what would be going on with my home while I was away. Because when you're away from home, your place could be an Airbnb. So why not consider becoming a host yourself? Because if you have a home, but you're not always at home, you pretty much have an Airbnb. Hosting is a great way to earn some extra money. Plus, hosting is a lot easier than you might think. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Coming back, you talk about at this point in your life wanting people to understand the work that you've made. Why don't we try to do that? Let's start with Rhythm Zero, which you performed in 1974 in Naples. Explain to people what exactly you did here.
You know, by that time, I was already doing my performance work. Performance artists in those days was heavily criticized as masochist, as sadist, this is exhibitionism, that's not art at all, and so on and so on. And I got very angry and very fatal in that time when you're young. And they say, okay, let me see if I do something and see what will happen. If I put 72 objects on the table, which have the objects for pleasure and objects for pain and torture, including pistol with one bullet, and also the simple instruction that you can use everything on the table as you want, pleasure, pain, including killing me, in 6 hours. And I take all responsibility. And I'm standing dressed in black shirt and black jeans in the front of this table. Wow, that was kind of pretty bold to do that. But I was ready to die. There was no question about it.
You were ready to die.
I was ready to die for art. You know, there is a wonderful the quotation of Bruce Nauman. He said, you know, the art is matter of life and death. Maybe sounds melodramatic, but it's also very true. This is how I took everything in my life, as a matter of life and death. This is why my work is so important to me. My work is everything I have. I pour my heart into it in every single work. And it's true and it's vulnerable. And this is why young generation can react on me that way, because they understand it's not bullshit. They understand that they have intuition, they have sense that I'm not playing anything. What I'm doing and what they see is what it is.
This is a matter of life and death. It's my understanding that a man placed a bullet in the pistol of one of your performances.
In that performance particularly. So for this performance, it was a normal gallery. People came from normal opening, not expecting anything. They came with their wives, they came and so. And these 6 hours, we are talking, you know, from the evening till 2 in the morning. And they were not expecting anything like that. Me standing there in the front of them, completely looking one point fixed, and all this possibility. So the first 3 hours they've been playing, they will give me the flower, they will feed me with a piece of cake, you know, all kinds of things that was available on the table for pleasure and playing. But I took 6 hours. I gave them time to actually develop dark side of themselves. And then they start playing. They cut me on my neck, drink my blood. They put the cotton around my shoulders and try to burn. They put the water over me. They carry me around, spread the legs, put the knife on the table between my legs. They done all of these things. Still, the one came with the pistol, put the bullet, put on my forehead. Somebody start fighting. They throw the pistol away. There was all this incredible tension. Everything with Italians done to me, if you see the photographs, is a reflection of three things. Poor Madonna, mother, three possibilities. The women would tell men what to do, and they would take my tears from my eyes. They would not do anything. And they cut my clothes, they exposed my breasts. When they, one gave me the rose, other one take the needles of the rose and stab into my breasts. I was standing there, and I absolutely didn't react. If they put my hand up, I leave that way. If they move me, I had no reaction at all, like a puppet. And this went on and on and on. The only they didn't rape me because they was there with the wives, but it could go in any direction. And after 6 hours, I was really naked, full of blood, wet, hair falling apart. It was horrible. The galleries came to me and whispered in my ear, 6 hours is finished. And I start moving towards them, to the public. They all ran away, literally. They ran away. They could not face me as me. And then I came to the hotel, I look myself in the mirror and a piece of gray hair in my hair.
After that performance you just described.
Gray hair.
With the gray hair, what did it tell you about people?
It was very important because actually two performances, it was very important to me. The Rhythm Zero and many, many years later, Artists is present because of the same reason, relation to public. Because in the first one, I really pushed the dark side. And I understand in that process that public can kill you. When I understood that, I didn't want to deal with that part anymore. Then artist is present, I restrict everything except eye gaze. No touching and no talking, just condition is sitting and eye gaze. There I lived human spirit. Because I knew the key how to do that. That was the moment that actually the only they can do is to go into themselves. But I need all these years in between to get that wise.
36 years
in between.
Between the two.
Yeah.
Throughout your career, you've created performances around self-infliction. You have Razor Blades to the Stomachs and Lips of Thomas, A Bed of Fire and Rhythm 5, taking pills for schizophrenia and rhythm two.
Oh my God, sounds so terrible.
But this performance in rhythm zero is different, like you said, because others are causing the pain. And I wonder how much you're drawing from your experiences growing up in post-war Yugoslavia. Here's a passage from your memoir. When I was small, when my mother and sister would slap me, I got blue bruises all over. My nose would bleed constantly. Then, when I lost my first baby tooth, the bleeding didn't stop for 3 months. I had to sleep sitting up in bed so I wouldn't choke. Finally, my parents took me to doctors to see what was wrong with me. At first, they thought it was leukemia. My mother and father put me in the hospital. I was there for almost a year. I was six. This was the happiest time of my childhood.
It's true. I sound so dramatic now. I look with total optimism and enthusiasm about this all hell I went through because I make me stronger. And I also understood this intention of my mother because, you know, in these diaries, I'm talking about her not ever kiss me or tell me I love you or something like that. And I never understood that coldness and the really suffering as a child was so much for that. But then when she died, I find her diaries and I read these diaries. And if I read one page of this diary during her lifetime, my relation to my mother would be very different.
Why is that?
Because she was emotional, suffering, father being totally unfaithful all the time, you know, have to have her career, two children to take care. And it was so hard. And I understand in her mind, the only way to make me strong is to make me warrior and cut me from all the emotional bullshit. That's how she saw it. But I didn't know that. I only knew this was that die. And then I really forgive this whole thing. So I'm looking at this like just experience, but also the later on, the things that I done to my body, it's not reason because I wanted to suffer or I want to, I'm interested in pain. It was much more related to the shamanism, to the rituals of different cultures. All of them deal with the facing the pain of the body and understanding the pain of the body and actually liberate themselves from the fear of the pain. And I just stage these things in the front of the public, go through this. And if I can do to myself and do this, the public can also get rid of their fear of the pain. Because pain is something that you can open the door. Pain keeps the secrets. It's kind of complicated to explain all that. But in a way, you know, right now, I mean, do I look too sick? Do I look, you know, unhealthy or I'm something disturbed? No, I'm actually pretty free because I understood the structure. And this was, you know, one of the reasons how to enlarge your consciousness by getting rid of fears that you have. Basic fear of pain, of dying, of suffering. And I had plenty in my life and took me 50 years to work this out.
Do you wish you could have forgave your mother or mended your relationship before she passed away?
Yeah, very much so. As I said, if I just read one page of the diary, it would be different. And I'm so sorry, I never did. My mother was a national hero that I didn't know either till I found the article and the medals in the little box under her bed because she never talked about the war. And my father always talked about the war. He was also a hero, but a different story. And she never talked. And she always had the light in her bedroom on. And I was always thinking because she's afraid of dark. And I don't think she was afraid of dark. She was pretty much have the guts. And that was amazing story. Do you want to know the story how she got the hero?
I know the story, but I would love for you to tell it.
So she was the commander of the Red Cross. She was like, I don't know, 27, too, like your age, on the front lines, picking up wounded soldiers to bring them in safety to the hospital. And there was occupation of Belgrade. And she had a truck with the six nurses, driver, and she picked up on the streets of Belgrade soldiers, 46 of them, put inside the car and was driving to get out to Belgrade to the hospital, which was not occupied. And in the process, the driver got killed and she had to remove all the soldiers with the six nurses to the sidewalk and the truck started getting fire. And she ran into the fire truck and take this the land phone that she can phone the hospital to send another truck. In meantime, four nurses got killed. So she's now with two nurses and her. New truck came, got all the soldiers back to the new truck. 46 of them saved their life. Not bad.
Not bad.
Not bad at all.
I keep thinking about her because throughout your memoir, you reference your relationship with her, especially in relation to how you loved. You write, "When I think back on all that happened between Ule and me and Paolo and me, I often wonder what I contributed to each split. And I can't help believing that the need to be loved and taken care of, that my mother never satisfied, was a hurt I brought to every man I was ever with and something that they couldn't fix." You're 75 now. How do you think about those loves today?
Oh, God, you know, I don't think anymore, because in the past, and each of them has suffered, and love with Paolo really broke my heart. And this is the reason why I done all this, the seven deaths of Maria Callas, because in her life, you know, Onassis broke her heart and she died. And for me, my work saved me from that dying, but I wanted to do something in memory of her. But finally, and right now, since 5 years, I'm in a relationship who is like, wow, I can't believe this is really happening. I've always believed the second shoes fall down and something terrible happen, because it's based on trust and love and happiness and incredibly peacefulness. And this so unknown territory for me. And it's working. So I think all the understanding and all mistakes and the kind of knowledge I get from the all failed relationships kind of pour into this one, that actually I think I'm more happy in my life than ever been. And it's like very unknown territory to walk in.
In fact, it's the exact opposite of territory we started with.
Absolutely. It takes a long time. But also, age is not bad at all. Because, you know, if you're old and sick, that's really sucks. But when you're old and happy and wise, I never want to go back when I was 20, 30, 40. It was too hard work.
So it's okay. So basically, I want to get this right. You said in the beginning of this conversation, if you had a happy childhood, it's going to be pretty hard for you as an artist.
Yeah.
But if you're a happy adult at 75, does that work?
Oh, yes, works, because you have all this knowledge that you didn't have when you were 25. And that knowledge counts a lot. Honestly, this is like, for me, the last part of my life, and it's so full of optimism and hope and happiness. And always I say the same thing, always about dying. All what I'm worrying about is to die without fear, consciously, and without anger. And if I succeed this, I done well in this life. Because, you know, as again Sufi said, life is a dream and death is waking up.
You said your last performance piece will be your death.
Not really that funeral, because that, you know, we don't know, but funeral, yes, organized funeral.
What is this project?
I just wanted to have happy ending. It's so important to have happy ending, you know, of one fulfilled life. And I really feel that I'm very lucky that my life is very fulfilled with so much events, good, bad, difficult, together, all of them. Just is kind of wonderful. That act of dying, you can't predict when. But the funeral, I don't want anybody organized for me. I like to be organized myself, to be celebration, dirty jokes, lots of music, nobody wear black, lots of food, and really remembering all of these happy moments, good music. You see, looks like Dad is knocking on our door or something.
It does. No. It does sound like death is knocking on our door. It means we have to wrap up.
It looks like this was such a wonderful conversation, and you hardly eat any cookie.
I'm going to eat some cookies. I have two things for you. We started with the artist is present. I want to go to one day after 2 months of performing, when a man in a wheelchair arrives at the front of the line. The guards remove the other chair and put him in his wheelchair across the table from you. And you said, "I looked at this man and I realized that I didn't even know if he had legs. The table was in the way." What happened that night when you went home?
Then I realized that I actually don't need a table. That is some kind of social structure that I constructed from the beginning, but I could not know there before, because this atrium is such a huge space. And if I just had the two chairs, I felt it was very little because it's already so minimal. You know, I put a table there. And this is the fear generally of very young artists when they think they need to put lots of stuff. And I literally all my career remove. But now I was only two chairs and table. I think, okay, this is pretty minimal. But then when this man came and I realized, I don't know if you have legs or not, I understood I don't need this table either. And this was incredibly important realization. Then when I came to MoMA next day, the security manager told me that it's not possible, that it's buffer between me and audience, that you have to have it. I said, yes, but this is my decision. And I removed the table. At that, everything changed. I was dressed in white and all energy was like so dense and relation was so intense, but I was ready for that intense relation because I already sit there 2 months before. So this is the process that you can't actually speed it up. You have to go slowly till you realize that you don't need anything.
This is the only time that you've made a major change in the middle of a piece, right?
Yes, only time. But it was totally necessary. And minimality of this piece, you know, because it's minimal, is so immaterial already. And that was the piece who changed my life.
Why did it change your life?
Yeah, because I realized that actually I have to work with audience. My work is people. That's my work. And the people have to also do the work themselves. This is why I create Abramovich Method. This is why I create Institute. It's all new function.
Removing the table from that performance, it reminded you of an Indian folk tale.
With a coffin.
Can you share that with people?
This king who buried a very beautiful princess in the world and they fall in love. And there was the most happy kingdom in the world. And she could become pregnant and delivering the child, she died. Or she became sick and she died. One of one other story, I don't remember exactly. And he was so devastated about his death that he put her in the simple wooden coffin and looked this coffin. And then he covered the coffin with emeralds and sapphires and gold and was not enough. And around this coffin, he created another one and then little temple. And the temple was not enough and he make a bigger temple. And then he started growing this huge kind of memorial about this he beloved princess, that actually the entire kingdom become the temple of her. And then he was looking there and there's nothing else to do. And he look and start saying to the builders, destroy the big temple, destroy the small temple, destroy this. And everything was left. It was just this coffin with the emeralds and jewels. And then he say, okay, now remove all the jewels. And there was only this simple wooden coffin there again. And then he looked at the coffin and he said, remove the coffin. That's the story I teach you a lot.
The story is our lives. We do all we can to fill it with people and places and things and performances and books we love. I'm looking around at your apartment, all these things.
But when you die, you can't take any of this. That's nothing. And this is why performance artists have incredible power of realization of so many things and kind of energy that other type of art doesn't have. And it's so difficult to maintain because it's immaterial, it's time-based. It takes everything from you.
And yet, it seems you still have more to give.
Till I die.
Is that a promise?
Yes, I don't stop.
Before we go, since I never had a chance to sit across from you during the artist is present.
Yeah.
Would you mind if we just sat here for a moment?
Close your eyes. I just want to say something. When you sit still and quiet, it's never stillness and quiet. because there's so much space inside your body, in your organs, between liver and kidneys, between your heart and ribs and so on. There is a movement everywhere. Then all the planet is moving around the axis, and then the planet is moving around the sun. And the sun and planets are moving around Milky Way, and everything is moving to another who knows where galaxies. And to understand all this is really to be still. And to understand actually stillness is being in the moment.
Well, Marina Abramović, I thank you very much for sitting in this moment with me, for all that you have done and will continue to do, and for inviting me into your home. No secrets at all.
No secrets, but please promise and come to the workshop next time to do the cleaning the house, your own body house.
It seems I have some work to do.
Okay, done.
Thanks for sitting with me.
Thank you.
And that's our show. If you enjoyed today's episode, be sure to leave us 5 stars on Apple, Spotify, wherever you do your listening. To learn more about Marina and her work, visit our website at talkeasypod.com. Once there, you'll find our back catalog of over 300 episodes, including talks with Joel Meyerowitz, Kehinde Wiley, Margaret Atwood, Zadie Smith, Toyin Oji Odutola, and Tom Hanks. To hear those and more Pushkin podcasts, listen on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you like to listen. You can also follow us on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram at TalkEasyPod. If you want to purchase one of our mugs, they come in cream or navy, or our vinyl record with writer Fran Lebowitz. You can do so at TalkEasyPod.com/shop. Talk Easy is produced by Caroline Reebok. Our executive producer is Janixa Bravo. Our associate producer is Caitlin Dryden. Today's talk was edited by Clarice Guevara and Caitlin Dryden and mixed by Andrew Vastola. Our music is by Dylan Peck. Our illustrations are by Krisha Shenoy. Video and graphics by Ian Chang, Derek Gabrizek, Ian Jones, and Ethan Seneca. I also want to thank our team at Pushkin Industries, Justin Richmond, Julie Barton, John Schnars, Carrie Brody, Heather Fain, Eric Sandler, Jordan McMillan, Kira Posey, Tara Machado, Jason Gambrell, Justine Lang, Malcolm Gladwell, and Jacob Weisberg. I'm Sam Fragoso. Thank you for listening to Talk Easy. I'll see you back here next Sunday with the one and only Z-Way. Until then, stay safe. And so on.
You know that feeling when you walk into your home, take a deep breath, and feel new? Well, that's what it's like to use Clorox Scentiva. Because Clorox Scentiva smells like coconut, cleans like Clorox, and feels like energy. It'll elevate any cleaning routine to not just clean, but also make every room smell like a tropical coconut getaway. Discover how Clorox Scentiva's powerful clean and refreshing scents can transform your space. Get yours in coconut or other fabulous scents at a nearby retail store.
This episode brought to you by 20th Century Studios' Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Director Wes Ball breathes new life into the epic franchise. As a ruthless king attempts to build his empire at the expense of the remaining human race, a young ape begins a journey to fight for a future for apes and humans alike. Kingdom of the Planet of the Apes. Enter the kingdom in IMAX on May 10th and theaters everywhere. Get tickets now.
Open a limited-time 11-month certificate at Kemba Financial Credit Union. At 5.25% APY, it's more than triple the national average, plus it's a safe and secure way to grow your money. Visit your local branch or kemba.org/cd for details. Offer expires May 31st, 2024. APY equals annual percentage yield. Restrictions apply. $500 minimum and $250,000 maximum deposit. Advantage status required. Comparison based on bank rate average. Federally insured by NCUA.